From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Yesterday, I met with President Bush and informed him of my decision to conclude my government service as Attorney General of the United States, effective as of September 17, 2007.
Alberto Gonzalez steps down as Attorney General. We'll speak with House Judiciary Chair John Conyers and Attorney Scott Horton.
The resignation of Alberto Gonzalez is putting the question of torture, Guantanamo, and related issues back in center stage in Washington again. We know down to the end, he was the last major ally of Vice President Cheney on these issues, so his replacement could make all the difference.
Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff is being touted as Gonzalez's replacement. We'll speak with a Justice Department whistleblower who charges Chertoff with misconduct in the prosecution of John Walker Lynn. And finally, psychologist and writer Mary Pfeiffer, author of Reviving Ophelia, returns her award from the American Psychological Association because she says it sanctions torture. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. After months of calls for his departure, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez has finally stepped down. Gonzalez made the announcement Monday, but didn't give a reason for his resignation.
Let me say that it has been one of my greatest privileges to lead the Department of Justice. I have great admiration and respect for the men and women who work here. I have made a point as Attorney General to personally meet as many of them as possible. And today I want to again thank them for their service to our nation. It is through their continued work that our country and our communities remain safe, that the rights and civil liberties of our citizens are protected, and the hopes and dreams of all of our children are secured.
The resignation comes just 2 weeks after the departure of one of Gonzalez's chief White House backers, Karl Rove. Gonzalez had been at the center of numerous congressional investigations, including the firing of 9 U.S. attorneys, the overall politicization of the White House, and the Bush administration's secret warrantless domestic surveillance operation. Besides serving as attorney general, Gonzalez was one of Bush's closest allies in Washington. Bush has been his only boss for the past 13 years. Speaking from Waco, Texas, President Bush defended the outgoing Gonzalez and assailed his critics.
After months of unfair treatment that has created a harmful distraction at the Justice Department, Judge Gonzalez decided to resign his position, and I accept his decision. It's sad that we live in a time when a talented and honorable person like Alberto Gonzalez is impeding from doing important work, because his good name was dragged through the mud for political reasons.
President Bush has named Solicitor General Paul Clement interim U.S. Attorney General. Clement has worked for former Attorney General John Ashcroft and Justice Antonin Scalia, and is a former member of the Federalist Society. As the announcement was made, protesters gathered outside the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. to applaud Gonzalez's departure. We'll have more on Gonzalez after headlines. In Afghanistan, the U.S. military is being accused of killing at least 12 civilians in a weekend airstrike in Helmand province. Afghan elders say U.S. warplanes killed 12 people, including 6 children and 2 women. Another 12 were reportedly wounded. The Pentagon's denying the claim and says Taliban fighters were responsible. More than 300 Afghan civilians have died in NATO airstrikes this year, more than have been killed in Taliban attacks. In other news from Afghanistan, the U.N. released a report Monday showing opium production has reached record levels. This is U.N. Drug Chief Antonio Maria Costa.
The opium situation in Afghanistan is disastrous, as recorded in our survey 2007 just released. The extent of the cultivation has increased by 17% to 193,000 hectares. There's no other country in the world which produces so much. I would say more than that. Afghanistan is producing more illicit drugs than all Andean countries combined, Peru, Bolivia, Colombia, of course.
A senior U.S. officer close to top Iraq commander General David Petraeus is among dozens of people under investigation for illicit activity in the sale and delivery of billions of dollars in weapons to Iraq. The New York Times reports a widening probe has already led to several indictments. The multi-agency investigation includes the Army Criminal Investigation Command, the Department of Justice, the FBI, and others. The senior officer, Lieutenant Colonel Lavanda Joey Self, worked closely with General Petraeus to set up logistics services for Iraqi forces. In other Iraq news, France's foreign minister has apologized for backing the replacement of Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Bernard Kouchner made the call in an interview with Newsweek magazine last week. On Monday, Kouchner said he had apologized directly to Maliki.
Because he was miffed. And basically, it's not the role of the French foreign minister to decide who will be prime minister or not in another country. There are criticisms of those Iraqis themselves that I wanted to pass on. And I clumsily, just once, in English, with a little video, forgot to say exactly what it was I had understood.
Maliki has also demanded an apology from Senators Hillary Clinton and Carl Levin for calling for his removal from office. In Greece, a devastating forest fire has now claimed the lives of at least 63 people. The government's handling of the disaster is turning into a political showdown. On Monday, hundreds marched through Athens, accusing the government of poorly responding to the crisis and failing to catch the arsonists. This is Panos Garganos of the Greek social justice group Enantia.
The scale of the tragedy is huge. People are very angry. This is the third time this summer that we've got this outbreak of fires. Many people have died, so people want to react. That was the message coming from all around.
Protesters say developers have committed several arsons to build on the land largely unprotected under Greek law. In Russia, a Chechen crime boss is being accused of organizing the murder of the journalist and human rights advocate Anna Politkovskaya. She was shot dead outside her home last October. She was a fierce critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Chechen war. On Monday, Chief Russian Prosecutor Yuri Chaika said Russian police and security officers were also involved in her killing.
We have made serious progress in the Politkovskaya murder investigation. 10 people have been arrested in connection with this case, and literally, in the very near future, they will be charged carrying out this grave crime.
Back in this country, public outcry is increasing as the execution date of a Texas man known to not have committed a crime draws near. Kenneth Foster is scheduled to be executed Thursday under a controversial Texas law known as the Law of Parties. The law imposes the death penalty on anybody involved in a crime where a murder occurred. 11 years ago, Foster was driving a car with three passengers. One of the passengers left the car, got into an altercation, and shot a man dead. Here in New York, a delegation of death penalty abolitionists held a news conference Monday to draw attention to Foster's case. This is exonerated former murder convict Jeff Diskovich.
It is unconscionable that nobody disputes that Mr. Foster did not commit a murder, and yet he is scheduled to be executed within 72 hours. I make a moral appeal for the people of Texas and people all across our country to stand up against the death penalty in general, and also in particular in the case of Kenneth Foster.
Monday's press conference comes one day after protesters demonstrated outside the church of Texas Governor Rick Perry to call for clemency. Amnesty International has also rallied behind Foster's case. In a statement, Amnesty USA Director Larry Cox said, quote, Kenneth Foster has been sentenced to death for leaving his crystal ball at home. Allowing his life to be taken is a shocking perversion of the law, he said. The American Civil Liberties Union has reached a settlement that it says will greatly improve conditions for children at the nation's main immigration prison for families. The ACLU filed the suit on behalf of 26 immigrant children held at the privately run T. Don Hutto Immigration Prison in Taylor, Texas. Under the agreement, the government pledges to improve child education, recreation, and nutrition, hire a full-time pediatrician, implement regular inspections, and install privacy curtains around toilets. The deal was reached just as the case was set to begin trial. All All 26 children named in the suit have been released since it was filed. Andre Restrepo, a 12-year-old from Colombia, said, quote, I'm trying to forget everything about Hutto. I feel free. It was a nightmare. Republican Senator Larry Craig of Idaho has confirmed a report he pleaded guilty this month to disorderly conduct following his arrest in a men's bathroom in Minneapolis. According to police, Craig was detained after he made a series of sexual advances to an undercover male officer. Last year, Craig denied a gay activist's claim he'd heard accounts of sexual encounters with a senator in men's bathrooms. Senator Craig has been criticized for opposing legislation on gay rights. He's voted against same-sex marriage and spoken out against homosexuals serving in the military. Craig says his actions were misinterpreted and that he shouldn't have pleaded guilty. The star football quarterback Michael Vick has pleaded guilty to operating an illegal dogfighting and Betty ring based in southeastern Virginia. Two of his co-defendants said Vick participated in the killing of at least eight dogs, some by hanging and drowning. On Monday, Vick publicly apologized after entering his plea.
I want to apologize to all the young kids out there. My immature acts, and you know, if what I did was very immature, so that means I need to grow up.
The National Football League has suspended Vic indefinitely. He faces up to 5 years in prison. And an American group is suing the internet giant Yahoo for allegedly aiding human rights abuses and torture in China. The World Organization for Human Rights says Chinese writers and dissidents have been arrested and abused out of Yahoo's sharing of information with the Chinese government. The journalist Shi Tao was jailed for 10 years after Yahoo passed on his email and internet protocol address to Chinese officials. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. After months of calls for his resignation, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez finally resigned Monday, just 2 weeks after one of his chief backers in the administration, Karl Rove, stepped down. Gonzalez had been at the center of numerous congressional investigations, including the firing of nine U.S. attorneys, the overall politicization of the White House and the Bush administration's secret warrantless domestic surveillance operation. Besides serving as Attorney General, Gonzalez was one of Bush's closest allies in Washington. For the past 13 years, Bush has been Gonzalez's only boss. In 1994, he was named general counsel to then-Texas Governor George W. Bush, later appointed and became Secretary of State of Texas, then to a seat on the Texas Supreme Court. Once Bush was elected, he named Gonzalez White House counsel. Then in 2005, Bush tapped him to replace Attorney General John Ashcroft. On Monday, President Bush held a short news conference to announce he reluctantly accepted Gonzalez's resignation.
After months of unfair treatment that has created a harmful distraction at the Justice Department, Judge Gonzalez decided to resign his position, and I accept his decision. It's sad that we live in a time when a talented and honorable person like Alberto Gonzalez is impeding from doing important work because his good name was dragged through the mud for political reasons.
An hour earlier, Gonzalez held one of the shortest news conferences in recent memory. It lasted 1 minute, 41 seconds. He never said why he was resigning.
Yesterday, I met with President Bush and informed him of my decision to conclude my government service as Attorney General of the United States, effective as of September 17, 2007. Let me say that it has been one of my greatest privileges to lead the Department of Justice. I have great admiration and respect for the men and women who work here. I have made a point as Attorney General to personally meet as many of them as possible. And today I want to again thank them for their service to our nation. It is through their continued work that our country and our communities remain safe, that the rights and civil liberties of our citizens are protected, and the hopes and dreams of all of our children are secured.
President Bush has named Solicitor General Paul Clement to be the interim U.S. Attorney General. He's worked for former Attorney General John Ashcroft and Justice Antonin Scalia, and is a former member of the Federalist Society. 3 years ago, he represented the government in the Supreme Court case Padilla versus Rumsfeld. He insisted the U.S. does not engage in torture. Congressmember John Conyers joins us on the phone now, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, which has been investigating Gonzalez's role in the politicization of the Justice Department and the warrantless domestic spy program. program. We're also joined by Scott Horton, Columbia Law professor and contributor to Harper's Magazine, where he writes the blog No Comment. Congressmember John Conyers, your reaction to the resignation of Alberto Gonzalez.
Good morning, Amy Goodman, the most distinguished communicator of news in this country. I'm happy to be on your program. To me, it was a sad day that the Attorney General resigned for the following reasons. What he did was leave amid a cloud of suspicion that the Department of Justice, the largest law enforcement agency in America, has been manipulated for political purposes. He didn't make any mention in this very brief statement about why he was resigning. And, of course, the suspicion among many of us is that it was only when the president wanted him to leave would he ever resign anyway. And so for him to resign as a patriot, and then the president to attack those who were seeking answers into the 9 firings of U.S. attorneys for what we think are political reasons continues this kind of veil that the president always uses to defend his conduct. And so the thought that the attorney general decided to resign unilaterally to me doesn't make much sense. But in addition to leaving the department in shambles, we've got the question of national security letters that were issued, thousands of people detained indefinitely, non-enforcement of voter rights, and permitting torture against our conventional treaties all go toward a very, very sad legacy that he leaves as Attorney General.
Where does this leave the congressional investigations, the Justice Committee, your committee's investigations into these issues?
The Judiciary Committee in the House continues on. As the Attorney General knows, this does not release him from any obligation to respond to our invitations to come or to be subpoenaed, or to be held in contempt. But at this point, the more interesting challenge to us is, why is the White House stonewalling Harriet Myers and the chief of staff who has the documents and letters that we need to have? Because the firings all clearly lead to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. You needn't be an investigator or a congressperson to understand that. And so this doesn't change anything. And as a matter of fact, by making this decision when the Congress was in recess and doing it in the way that it was orchestrated, only raises the question even to a higher level of what might they be trying to prevent us from finding out.
On the issue of torture, how is the Judiciary Committee pursuing this issue? Gonzalez's role, but beyond Gonzalez, the policy that continues?
We're continuing to hold hearings. This is going to go on for some time. It's very clear that they're resisting the contempt citations for not honoring our process of requiring them to come before us. They're trying to run the clock out on us, and we'll likely end up in court. But the investigations will continue. We've got so much to find out. The voter rights department is in shambles. As a matter of fact, they're now doing reverse voter rights enforcement, where blacks are being found to have violated the rights of white voters, and of all places, the state of Mississippi, where voting resistance has been one of the greatest. So we're still in this, and we're still moving forward as quickly as we can. There's likely to be a contempt citation voted by the Congress to Harriet Myers for her refusal to even come before the committee to explain that she was using whatever right she chose to use to refuse to honor our subpoena before the Judiciary Committee.
Congressman Conyers, it was interesting to see you at this major rally in Newark on Saturday. About more than 1,000 people were there. It was the largest demonstration against war and violence at home for decades in Newark. Now, you spoke on the at the rally. Interestingly, people were there who'd been arrested in your office, the 45 in July, who'd been arrested because they were calling for you to continue to back the call for impeachment of President Bush. What is your response?
Well, my response is that we have several things to do, and I begin this part of our conversation by indicating that I have nothing but the highest regard for Cindy Sheehan. But the question of how we orchestrate moving a congressional schedule forward of accomplishments. We're pretty proud of what we've done in 8 months after having no control over the agenda for 12 years. We also are trying to make sure that we don't bring resolutions or hearings that would put the election in jeopardy. We could close down the Congress. I've been in more impeachment hearings than anybody on in the House or the Senate, and our legislative attempts to reverse so many things would come to a stop, and it is doubtful if we wouldn't go into an election with not one, but at least two attempts to remove the top executive officers in the country.
Congressman Conyers,
I don't think that can happen.
On the issue of wireless, of the warrantless wiretapping, on the one hand, you've had the Democrats going after Gonzalez fiercely for the Bush administration's secret warrantless domestic surveillance program, yet signing off on the recent bill that the Bush administration had pushed for further warrantless wiretapping.
Well, the leadership was, of course, against the bill. And the majority of Democrats voted against the bill. But we've got this consideration. We've got 233 Democrats. 40 of them are blue dogs, that is, conservative Democrats that frequently vote Republican. And then we have another group that are new to the Congress in their first term, elected by, elected from red state congressional districts, which they felt that they would not be able to come back, and we couldn't get them over. So we didn't have all of our Democrats. It was not a solid position, but the leadership, Pelosi, and I, and Reyes, the head of the Intelligence Committee. We pleaded with everybody to vote with us in caucus, and we weren't able to persuade some of the new members, and we weren't able to persuade some of the blue dogs.
Why would impeachment hearings put the election in jeopardy?
Well, because unless I've got the Constitution in one hand and a calculator in the other, So any kind of hearings on removing both the president and the vice president, or putting it in reverse, remove the vice president and then the president within the months remaining, would require 218 votes in the House of Representatives. That's my calculator giving me this information. And then in the Senate, we need two-thirds to convict. Notwithstanding all of my progressive friends that would love to see me start impeachment hearings, those votes I do not think exist in the House of Representatives or in the U.S. Senate.
Finally, Congressman Conyers, if you weren't holding your calculator, if you were just deciding whether impeachment was called for here, what would be the reasons you would list?
What would be the reason that I would what?
What would be the reasons you would list for impeachment if you weren't holding your calculator, just holding the Constitution?
Well, to me, we can accomplish probably as much as we would need to make the record clear that there has been a great deal of violation of the sworn oath of office, abuses of power, through the hearings and inquiries that we can conduct. But it isn't that, no one has ever heard me suggest that we don't think that there is conduct that could be proven to be impeachable. But when Ron Dellums and Shirley Chisholm and Bella Abzug and William Fitzryan of New York, when we, Perrin Mitchell, when we introduced an impeachment resolution, the first one against a sitting president in over 75 years when Richard Nixon was being investigated, it was at the beginning of his term, and although he had been overwhelmingly reelected, there was time for us to have the hearing. The timing of an administration which will go down in history is probably one of the most disappointing. There isn't the time here for it.
Congressman Conyers, we will leave it there. Chair of the House Judiciary Committee, I want to thank you very much for joining us on this day after the announcement that Alberto Gonzalez had resigned as Attorney General effective September 17th. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. Would I Lie to You, the Eurythmics, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Scott Horton, Columbia Law professor, contributor to Harper's Magazine, where he writes the blog No Comment. Scott Horton, you have been dealing with the issue of the U.S. attorney firings, as well as the issue of torture. Your reaction to Alberto Gonzalez resigning as attorney general and what this means?
Well, I think it's an important breaking point for this administration. It'll be an important point at which to re-examine policy issues but also to proceed with an investigation of these accusations. I think Alberto Gonzalez had been blocking the appointment of a special prosecutor who had been called for by many in Congress, I think including Congressman Conyers, we just heard from. I think with a new nominee going up, the Congress is going to be in a very strong position to force the appointment of that prosecutor to look into politicization of the U.S. Attorney's Office, but also questions, as we discussed last week, and I think as the New York Times notes in its editorial today, the very curious political prosecution of Governor Siegelman in Alabama. Similarly, Alberto Gonzalez and Dick Cheney were the two last remaining key players in the Bush administration in favor of keeping Guantanamo open, in favor of the use of highly coercive techniques and interrogation, torture techniques. With his departure, then his replacement's going to play a key role in those decisions. So who comes in after him could very well affect a change in the policy with respect to Guantanamo and coercive interrogation. We know, for instance, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, both want to see Guantanamo closed. Both of them opposed the executive order of July 20th.
Can you talk about Gonzalez's history? You have President Bush yesterday saying he's simply being dragged through the mud in a hyper-politicized climate. Didn't quite use those words. But what about Gonzalez? What exactly is his role?
Well, I think President Bush is absolutely correct that this is about politicization, but it's really about Alberto Gonzalez's politicization of the Department of Justice. That's been the key issue from the beginning, and I think the evidence of that is quite strong and compelling. And in fact, I think we don't need to look too much further than Alberto Gonzalez himself for that story, because Alberto Gonzalez is someone whose entire career was based on his tight personal connection with George W. Bush. I mean, he's not someone who's really held in high regard by the legal profession. I think in his last months in the Department of Justice, he was someone who was held really in low esteem by his own colleagues at the Department of Justice. I think, as is witnessed by several meetings he held with senior staff, which were described as frosty.
Last month, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing on misconduct at the Department of Justice. I want to play a clip of Illinois Democratic Senator Richard Durbin questioning Alberto Gonzalez on the use of torture. Senator Durbin listed five interrogation techniques that the highest-ranking attorneys in the U.S. military had said violated Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. There are painful stress positions, threatening detainees with dogs, forced nudity, waterboarding, and mock executions.
Would it be legal for a foreign government to subject a United States citizen to these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, which I just read?
Would it be legal for the United States government to subject?
No, for a foreign government.
For a foreign government.
To subject a United States citizen to the five, any of the five interrogation techniques which I read to you?
Well, again, Senator, we would take the position, if you're talking about an American soldier who fights pursuant to the rules of the Geneva Convention.
It's a different story. It's a uniformed person. I'm talking about a U.S. citizen.
Would it be legal under their laws? Would it be legal under international standards? What do you mean by would it be legal?
Alberto Gonzalez answering the questions of Senator Dick Durbin. Your response, Scott Horton.
Well, of course, he didn't answer the questions. I think his appearance on this issue was a complete embarrassment. The reason he didn't answer the questions is that he clearly staked out a position supporting the use of these techniques, which very clearly are illegal and I think have brought the United States into disrepute around the world. In fact, earlier this year, he was down in Buenos Aires for a meeting with the president of Argentina and their attorney general. And the last minute, the president refused to meet with him, and they issued a statement saying that it was inconceivable for a person like Alberto Gonzalez, who had embraced torture and abuse, to be received in the Casa Rosada in Argentina. And I think we see that reflected all around the world. He really brought our nation and its administration of justice into grave disrepute.
Explain further what you mean about a special prosecutor and what that would mean.
Well, we're not talking about independent counsel anymore because that old statute has expired, but the attorney general does have the power to appoint an independent prosecutor to take on and investigate matters where the appropriate U.S. attorney is disqualified because of conflicts of interest. That statute exists. That practice has existed for hundreds of years. And I think there's been a longstanding consensus. I think it was first advanced by Neil Katyal from Georgetown University, but I think most people in the legal community now embrace it, that there should be an independent prosecutor appointed to look into the politicization of the U.S. attorneys, the political prosecutions that have gone on, and the numerous false statements that were made before Congress by Alberto Gonzalez, by Paul McNulty, and by other senior officials in the Justice Department. Many of them have come out subsequently and acknowledged that they made false statements. That's a very, very serious matter and usually requires an inquiry.
President Bush has named Solicitor General Paul Clement to serve as acting attorney general. Meanwhile, there's been much speculation about who Bush will nominate to replace Gonzalez. Names mentioned in the press include Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, former Solicitor General Theodore Olson, Homeland Security Advisor Francis Fragus Townsend, and former Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson. Jesslyn Raddick joins us now from Washington, D.C. She's a former attorney in the Ethics Department of the Justice Department. She worked at the Justice Department after the September 11th attacks and dealt with the John Walker Lynn case. At the time, Michael Chertoff headed the criminal division of the Justice Department. 2 years ago, Jesslyn Raddick was a vocal critic of Chertoff's nomination as Homeland Security Director. Jesslyn Raddick, take us through what happened with John Walker Lynn, right through Michael Chertoff's involvement.
Michael Chertoff was involved from the get-go. I had been the ethics advisor at the Justice Department in the case of the so-called American Taliban, John Walker Lind, and I had basically advised not to interrogate him without counsel.
Explain again who John Walker Lind was.
John Walker Lind was an American citizen who was caught fighting alongside the Taliban, along with Yasser Hamdi, another U.S. citizen who was recently released to Saudi Arabia. And we prosecuted him. He was one of the first people tagged with the dubious enemy combatant label by the Bush administration.
And so tell us what happened and your role, and then Michael Chertoff's.
Basically, the Justice Department disregarded the advice of the ethics unit not to interrogate him without a lawyer, went ahead, interrogated him, and by the pictures we've seen worldwide, tortured him, and then went ahead to prosecute him. Basically, Judge Ellis, who was overseeing the prosecution, ordered that all Justice Department correspondence related to the Lind interrogation be turned over to the court. That order was concealed from me. I found out about it inadvertently from the prosecutor. And when I went to comply with the order, my emails with the advice not to interrogate him without counsel and the fact that the FBI had committed an ethics violation in doing so were missing from the file. I resurrected those emails from my computer archives and tried to get them to the prosecutor, and when that failed, I turned them over to the media. As punishment, again, this was all under Michael Chertoff, who at that time was the Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division. Under Chertoff, I was placed under criminal investigation for what I was never told. I was forced out of the Justice Department, fired from my next job at the government's behest, referred to the state bars in which I'm licensed as an attorney based on a secret report to which I did not have access, and put on the no-fly list. And all of that occurred on Michael Chertoff's watch. So to the extent that President Bush seeks to rehabilitate the beleaguered Justice Department, I think Chertoff is a very odd choice for that.
Michael Chertoff was asked about the John Walker Lynn case when he was being confirmed as Secretary of Homeland Security, and you also testified against him. Can you explain what happened there?
Well, in his Chertoff, I've been a stumbling block to two of his promotions because, unfortunately, that seems to be the Bush credo, to mess up, cover up, lie, and get promoted. But during those confirmation hearings, Chertoff said unambiguously that the ethics unit had never given an opinion about the interrogation of John Walker Lind. And that was contradicted by the public record, by both articles in Newsweek and in The New Yorker. Yet Chertoff kept repeating that assertion two or three times, including in written statements. That was during his confirmation to become a federal judge. And he was eventually confirmed to be a federal judge. But again, this issue of lying came up during his confirmation hearing to be director of the Department of Homeland Security. And again, Chertoff is just as much of a perjurer as Alberto Gonzalez. I just think that his time at the Justice Department has been largely forgotten or overlooked because it's been so eclipsed by his abysmal performance at the Department of Homeland Security.
Scott Horton, I'm looking at an email that involves Michael Chertoff. Explain what this is, involving whether Michael Chertoff lied to Congress about Guantanamo.
Well, it's yet another incident, I think, along with Jocelyn Raddick's, which to me is a very, very, very troubling one. He was asked about the development of torture policy and his role in it, whether he knew about abuses that had gone on at Guantanamo that had been reported by FBI agents to his office. He testified that he knew nothing about this and that he had not been involved in the formulation of torture policy, nor that he gave him much advice. He acknowledged that he knew about the torture memorandum, by the way, the so-called Bybee memorandum. But I think things...
Explain what it said.
The Bybee memorandum is the memorandum that was actually authored by John Yoo that authorized torture, basically, saying that if the president authorized it, whatever he authorized was fine, and it would not be considered to be torture under American criminal law as long as it had presidential authorization. So they included things like waterboarding. Well, after his testimony, in fact, around the time of it, some of the documents came out, but subsequently much more information came out, really calling into question the veracity of Chertoff's testimony here. And I think that email that you're holding up is one of the key documents. So that email reflects a number of FBI agents briefing Chertoff's chief of staff and his counsel about highly abusive conduct that was going on at Guantanamo, recounting that they protested about it, they raised questions about it with Major General Miller and others, all to no avail. The Department of Defense continued with the use of these highly abusive techniques. We know subsequently that the CIA came to Chertoff and to his deputy, Alice Fisher, who now heads the criminal division, trying to get clarification based on the torture memorandum. They wanted him to say, as the head of the criminal division, that as long as these techniques, these torture techniques, were used by CIA agents, their contractors and their personnel were not going to face criminal prosecution. He has denied repeatedly that he gave any such assurances. I'm being told that he did, and that was a major part of his consultation in connection with the torture memorandum.
Scott Horton, I also want to ask about Paul Clement, who President Bush has tapped as acting attorney general. In 2004, he represented the Bush administration before the Supreme Court in the case Donald Rumsfeld versus Jose Padilla. In this exchange with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, he insisted the U.S. does not torture.
If the law is what the executive says it is, whatever is necessary and appropriate in the executive's judgment, that's the resolution you gave us that Congress passed, and it leaves it up to the executive, unchecked by the judiciary. So what is it that would be a check against torture?
Well, first of all, there are treaty obligations, but the primary check is that just as in every other war, if a U.S. military person commits a war crime by creating some atrocity on a harmless, you know, detained enemy combatant or a prisoner of war, that violates our own conception of what's a war crime, and we'll put that U.S. military officer on trial in a court-martial. So I think there are plenty of internal reasons.
Suppose the executive says mild torture, we think, will help get this information. It's not a soldier who does something against the code of military justice, but but it's an executive command. Some systems do that to get information.
Well, our executive doesn't, and I think, I mean...
But what's constraining, that's the point. Is it just up to the goodwill of the executive? Is there any judicial check?
Well, this is a situation where there is jurisdiction in the habeas courts. So if necessary, they remain open. But I think it's very important. I mean, the court in Ludecky against Watkins made clear that the fact that executive discretion in a war situation can be abused is not a good and sufficient reason for judicial micromanagement and overseeing of that authority. You have to recognize that in situations where there is a war, where the government is on a war footing, that there, you have to trust the executive.
That was U.S. Deputy Solicitor General Paul Clement, now the acting attorney general, once Alberto Gonzalez leaves. Scott Horton, this argument he's making before the Supreme Court.
Well, I think first we've got to note that the fact that the president has to go down the line to the number four figure in the Department of Justice to find an acting attorney general shows the depth of the problem in that institution right now. It's effective decapitation and loss of leadership. That being said, I think Paul Clement is amongst the leading figures in the Department of Justice, the one who's the most highly respected. But I think this clip you've just played reflects some of the troubles that some people have with Paul. I think he is very ideologically oriented. He was a member of the Federalist Society. And I think he's gone out on a ledge to support the administration several times. I think the passage you just played, two things. I mean, he's denying that there were torture practices there. I think the facts really undercut what he said. And secondly, he's also saying, don't worry, habeas corpus will be available to provide review. And, of course, it wasn't. In fact, he worked very hard to avoid it.
By the way, the date of that was April 28th, 2004, the argument before the Supreme Court was being questioned by Ruth Bader Ginsburg a few hours later, if that long. The Abu Ghraib photos were released.
But certainly people in the administration knew about that several weeks beforehand. So he was closing his eyes if he didn't know about it.
Jesslyn Raddick, as we wrap up with you, in one of your writings now, as Michael Chertoff's name comes up as the possible attorney general, you start off by saying, yes, there is the case that I can talk about, my own case, John Walker Lynn, but wouldn't Katrina be enough?
Well, one would think that Katrina would be enough, and his spectacular failure in heading the Department of Homeland Security should be enough to caution against him serving as Attorney General. But again, I ask people to reflect back on the fact that Michael Chertoff had been at the Justice Department before in a leadership role. Shortly after 9/11, he had been the head of the criminal division. He had been at the Justice Department before. And on his watch, a lot of atrocious things occurred, including, as Scott Horton mentioned, torture. And again, while most people may not remember my case, I've written about it in my book, Canary in the Coal Mine. It's out there. I've detailed Chertoff's perjury during his previous confirmation hearings to other positions of power. And while, yes, his performance at the Department of Homeland Security should be enough to preclude any consideration of him for the nation's top law enforcement position, I think one could also easily look to his record when he was, in fact, at the Department of Justice.
Jesslyn Raddick, I want to thank you for being with us. Yes, former attorney in the Ethics Department of the Justice Department. Her book, The Canary in the Coal Mine, Blowing the Whistle in the Case of American Taliban, John Walker Lynn. Scott Horton, your final comment as we look at Alberto Gonzalez resigning, the possibility of Michael Chertoff replacing him and Paul Clement as the acting attorney general right now.
Well, I'll just follow up on the comment that was just made about Chertoff's tenure at the criminal division. I think that's right. If we look, he ran that division. He also appointed one of his closest protégés, Noel Hillman, as the head of the public integrity unit. So it is while he was running that division and his protégé was running public integrity that we had prosecutions at the ratio of 7-1 of elected Democrats against Republicans, including the Siegelman matter beginning. So
Siegelman, the Alabama governor who's now in prison.
Precisely. And so I think this entire process of politicization of the prosecutorial process is going on under Michael Chertoff's watch. So if we want a new attorney general who's going to come in and straighten things out and restore the integrity and reputation of the Department of Justice, Michael Chertoff is an awfully odd choice for that.
Well, Michael Chertoff has not been announced. If they were announcing him this week, it would be on the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Do you think right now they're floating that name, as has been done before, to see what the public's response would be?
That's precisely what's going on. I think it's clear that there's a list of a half dozen names. He's the number one name on the list because he's been reconfirmed 3 times for offices in the last 5 years. So I think people in the White House think he is confirmable. They floated the name now to see what sort of problems he's going to face. And I think they may have underestimated the problems.
Scott Horton, thanks for joining us. Columbia Law professor, contributor to Harper's Magazine, writes the blog No Comment. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to Lincoln, Nebraska, the author of Reviving Ophelia, a well-known psychologist and writer who has returned her presidential citation from the American Psychological Association because she says the group that she once loved supports torture. Stay with us.
Yes, the left wing's broke.
Bonnie DeFranco, your next bold move here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish, and transcript and in audio for any radio station to take, as over 150 are around the world. Our website, again, is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The American Psychological Association has come under public criticism once again over its endorsement of professional involvement in CIA and military interrogations. At its annual convention just over a week ago, the APA's policymaking council voted overwhelmingly to reject a measure that would have banned its members from participating in interrogations at Guantanamo Bay and other U.S. detention centers. In the days since the convention ended, the Houston Chronicle, one of the nation's most widely read newspapers, criticized the move in an editorial writing, quote, "Psychologists have no place assisting interrogations at places such as Guantanamo Bay." Then, in an even more dramatic development, renowned psychologist and New York Times bestselling author Mary Pfeiffer decided to return her presidential citation award from the APA in protest. In a letter to the group's president, she wrote, quote, "I have struggled for many months with this decision, and I make it with pain and sorrow. I do not want an award from an organization that sanctions its members' participation in the enhanced interrogations at CIA black sites and at Guantanamo." Mary Pfeiffer is author of a number of books, including Reviving Ophelia, which has remained on the New York Times bestseller list for 154 weeks. She joins us now from Lincoln, Nebraska, where she lives. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mary Pfeiffer.
Hello. Thank you very much, Amy. I'm honored to be on your show.
Can you talk about this decision you have come to and how you came to it, to return your presidential citation to the American Psychological Association?
You know, it's a life decision. There's childhood aspects, there's my adult life as a person who's worked with traumatized people, and then there's the last week. Speaking first of the last week, Amy, I heard your show last Monday, and I was aware of this issue. I'd read the Jane Mayer article in The New Yorker. I read the Vanity Fair article. But when I heard your show and then looked up the substitute motion 3 that basically allowed psychologists to continue participating in interrogations, I really felt that I had a moral choice to make. And I no longer wanted to be associated with APA. I also have been in the public eye enough that I realized if I just wrote a letter to APA, it would fall in a black hole, which in fact it did. I've never had a response from them. That I also wanted to make a few calls to people and let them know I was doing this so that my fervent hope by my action is two things. One, that American Psychological Association will rapidly rethink what I consider a terrible mistake and regain its position as a helping organization and regain its respect among other helping organizations such as the American Medical Association, American Psychiatric Association, who do not permit their members to work in many of the places psychologists are now working. The other thing is, psychologists at this point are the only people who are giving the CIA and President Bush legitimacy for the kinds of behaviors that are occurring in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, the black sites, and so on. Because when he's asked about those things, why is this different, say, than Egypt or the Congo? His answer is, we have medical supervisors who are overseeing the interrogations. In fact, psychologists are those medical supervisors. So if we can rapidly change substitute motion 3, if we can take a very strong stand on banning participation of members at these places, it will be all over. There won't
Dr. Mary Pfeiffer, I want to thank you for joining us. We're going to continue the conversation after has returned her award to the American Psychological Association, author of Reviving Ophelia. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.